Good morning, everybody. We're happy to get this next panel started. My name is Ryan Roche. I'm with BRR Architecture. BRR is a national architecture firm. We work with retailers and developers all across the country. We've worked with a lot of brands like Walmart, Nike in our time, over our history. Currently, here locally in Austin, we're working a lot with Whole Foods and HEB.
Adam Zimmel with Endeavor. And been with the company about 9 years, historically spent a lot of time in the brokerage side, moved over to development side, worked with a team of five or six talented guys and gal on the development side for retail in Central Texas.
I'm Jeff Niebrat. I'm the managing partner for the Weitzman here in Austin, if you're not familiar with Weitzman. We're a vertically integrated company with development, management, and a brokerage group here in town, and other three major markets in Texas.
Roger Plord, Ivy Companies, newly formed company. It was formerly with Termage Equities, where we developed all of Music Lane. Since forming Ivy, we acquired Cease Village here in Tarrytown and have a couple other acquisitions that I hope will close around the middle of this year.
Hi, this is Bo Avery. I'm the president of Tramarch Properties. We specialize only in shopping centers. We have about 2 million square feet in two states, about 1 million square feet in Austin MSA. And we love this market. Very low vacancy, so very high demand.
My name is David Spagnolo. I'm with Whitestone REIT. We are a retail landlord headquartered out of Houston, Texas. I oversee our operations in Austin and San Antonio, as well as Dallas and Fort Worth.
Well, great. We've got an amazing group here today, so we have a lot to talk about. Let's dive in. First, I'd like to invite each of you to talk about the current opportunities you see in the Austin market, whether there's some current developments that you're able to talk about with the group today, or just things you're seeing currently in Austin and the surrounding areas. Adam, we'll start with you.
I think you heard some of the sentiment on the last panel. The market's extremely tight and demand is high. We're in a really great market being Austin, really smart, educated, good incomes, and retail follows housing, and housing growth primarily is on the outskirts of town. And so that's where we historically have played very heavily on the retail development side, more focused on ground up opposed to acquisition of existing. And that's currently where we're focused. So when I say outskirts of town, that's the Mainers, it's Georgetown, it's Liberty Hill, down south it's the Kyle, out west it's Drippin. So kind of all over the place.
Jeff?
Yeah, I'll echo what Adam said there. Demand is really hard to create, but demand is easy to fill. And there is no doubt a gap that exists in this marketplace. We have not seen a tremendous amount of development over the last 7 to 8 years in retail. Last year was an up year with almost 700,000. However, the majority of that was anchors HEB and Costco. But the focus on our end is also in the peripheral markets where the new growth is. We just have to figure out there are some real challenges in the metrics and the economics of making deals work in these markets. And so, but the demand is there, and I think if you can control the demand, we'll be able to bridge that gap in the coming year.
I think we heard it from the tenant panel, right? There was a call for a third place. I think that in Austin there's room for a third, fourth, and fifth place, and that's probably just within what John would have defined as the urban core. If you go around in other markets, even like-kind markets like a Nashville or a Denver or other similar sized cities, let's just say you have a tenant rep broker and they're bringing a new tenant on a tour. They're going to go and they're going to check out five or six different places. In Austin, the tenant rep broker is going to bring the tenant into the market. They're going to go to Domain. They're going to go to South Congress, maybe some other place if they're interested more in the periphery, and then they're going to go get a beer, right? So I think that there's tremendous opportunity within the urban core to create, you know, those new places, but then also within the immediate periphery. I think there's a desire in that immediate periphery for these engaging projects that you find more in the urban core in terms of architecture and design and retail curation. If you bring those ingredients out into that immediate periphery, I think there's some opportunity to be had there as well.
Well, I'm not a developer. I'm actually just a landlord, so I don't develop any.
Smart guy.
So I would say one of the best advantages of a market that has demand like this, there's a couple of different ways to look at deals. You could see a deal and say, yeah, that's a really good deal. But when you have a very well-leased asset, you can hold out for the quote-unquote great deal. And from where I come from, as a landlord, you're always looking to improve your NOI, but when there's demand drivers like you see in Austin, this is where you can quote-unquote maximize your NOI, and those are the kind of opportunities that I'm most looking forward to, and not just this year, in the coming years as well.
You know, Adam, we were talking a lot about the lack of inventory and high demand for inventory too, but you know, what trends do you see going forward? If it is third places, fourth places, fifth places, you know, how would you, you know, develop these future properties for retail to really separate, you know, something you're working on to design it to stand out differently from what your competitors might be doing?
I think it depends where, you know, what part of the city you're talking about. We've got a handful of urban-related projects that we're working right now, more traditional mixed use. Obviously, the office world has changed quite a bit, so it leans more towards retail with maybe hotel, it might be condo, and then multifamily. And so, you know, I think that there's probably a greater effort put on the curation of the mix of tenants in those examples. Right now, we're in the entitlement phase on a handful of those, or the design phase at this point, because economically it doesn't make sense to go build those. And so I think for those urban projects, they talked a little bit about it, where, you know, restaurants really do act as an anchor, and so that's a category that Austin absolutely loves and that you can really build around. When you're talking about the outskirts of town, we'd call it more horizontal mixed use, and so, you know, there are fewer and fewer pure just retail projects. We're working on larger scale projects at this point, and they might be residential driven, they might be multifamily, they might have medical component, you know, hotels, and then retail, obviously. I did look back, and we've got our brokerage team of four, and of the 132 deals, about 10 of them were purely retail. So, you know, sub 10% of, you know, we're sitting on a retail panel for retail development, and I think it just emphasizes how much restaurant service type users drive the category for us today, and then supplementing with those other types of uses, product types, you know, at projects.
Jeff, what's your take?
I mean, we are what I would consider to be more of the blue collar developer in the category, and still hold a lot of confidence and faith in small strip centers that focus on sustainability in tenants, and that is, you know, it, as Adam said, restaurant and service. And, you know, whereas, you know, 10, 15 years ago you were focused on more soft good users, you are building around restaurants and service, and what, you know, we may get to this, you know, further in the conversation, but retail as a whole, it's been really interesting to see kind of the evolution post-COVID. You know, we've had a number of periods where we're like, retail is dead. And I think what we have learned and what we have come to today is is a pretty good happy place, if you will, because we all came out of COVID with greater skills in purchasing online, but we missed the experience of shopping. And so I think that we're now in a stage where we're back to not only retail and service, but a lot of these other soft good users, they're here to stay. And so there's a blended mix that we feel in the peripheral markets is very sustainable long term, and so feel good about that.
Bo, you're more in the existing shopping center market. Talk about those opportunities for you.
Well, the vacancy in this market is so little, like less than 1%. And I usually choose to go with a plus A shopping center and basically list themselves. So the demand is so high that I have maybe 20 phone calls a week, and I only have one space to lease. So it's a great market. I wish I had more product in this market. I want about 1 million square feet. I wish I had more. But the vacancy factor is so low and the demand is so high. You talk about restaurants. I have 10 restaurants in my shopping center averaging $1,000 a foot in sales. And I'm in a Domain market. I'm right next to Domain. It's called Arbor Walk. And amazing location that cannot be replaced. 45 acres facing North Mopac, a breaker. So summary to all this, location is everything. In this specific market, tenants will come to you based on location, demographics, traffic, and we have over 3,000 parking spaces. We have 10 boxes that are doing very well. Grocery store with a Home Depot, so it's a great mix of tenants, and the co-tenancy is really selling itself.
Can I ask you a question, Bo? Out of those 20 calls, how many of them are for vape shops?
Well, it's on a website saying I don't do any vape shops. So nobody call me on vape shops. They know I'm not going to do it.
You know, it was interesting what you said, Jeff, about, people thought retail was going to die. And we've heard that so many times. But what's more true is that retail just is continually evolving. And something comes up and changes the course of what retail is, whether it's online business or whatever that is, but it's certainly, it's not dying. It is evolving, Dave. And I was curious, something you said to me earlier, those demands are always changing. So talk about that and some of those trends you're seeing and what you're planning for your developments.
Over to me.
For David.
Yeah. Boy, I hate to pick the COVID Band-Aid because I think we're all through that, but going back to 2020, just seeing how the local mom-and-pop types evolved, a lot of the national groups kind of toss their hands up. They're like, oh, well, it is what it is. We'll get through this or we won't. But just, figuring out, hey, I could put a few patio tables on the sidewalk and the city's not going to write me up anymore, or we're going to do more takeout and stuff like that. So I think there's just the strong will survive no matter what opportunity is in front of them. And the good operators always do find a way. And obviously those are the operators you want to wrap your arms around and expand them significantly into multiple locations. Coming out of that too, I'm kind of happy to see that I don't have to deal with force majeure language nearly as much in the lease comment process as we did a few years ago. So hoping that just leave that to the attorneys and let that go away in the future.
And Roger, when we were preparing for this panel, you said something interesting just about the tech industry itself and how it relates to the demand for retail space and the growth in Austin. I'd be curious if you could expand upon that for our audience.
I'll just bring COVID back for 1 second. I thought that COVID was the ultimate consumer experiment, right? You put people in their houses for 2 months, and you say, do you want to go back out and do stuff? And the answer resoundingly was yes, we absolutely want to go out and do stuff. And I thought that was a just transformational moment for the retail investment business, because that was universal across. We had the entire world get shut down and the entire world want to come back out and go out of their house and do stuff, whether that's eating, shopping, or doing whatever. And so that was just a massive, almost underappreciated moment, I think, for our world. As it relates to the tech business, you know, the number one question I always get, I've gotten from investors for the past, you know, 6 or 7 years investing here is, what happens if the tech business falters? What happens if we see small and mid caps get crushed? And that has been happening now for the past year. And my response to those investors was always that Austin's economy has diversified, right? There is government, there is healthcare, there is military, and there is very extremely large cap tech, right? That is going to support the small and mid caps in an event of a contraction like this. And I think so far, right, that's a prescient prediction. We'll see. I think there's probably still some more, you know, carnage to be seen in that small and mid-cap tech space throughout the course of this year and maybe next year as a lot of those cash balances start to reduce. But the economy, I think, has held up really, really strong, and we have not seen any, you know, real contraction in retail sales, right? So we've seen a contraction in the small and mid-caps, but there hasn't really been a resulting contraction in retail sales. So that, to me, was really encouraging and is a strong just sort of data point to be putting out there to investors.
And then we heard some comments from the previous panel about amenities and things that they'd like to see, you know, brought in into these developments, and you know, grease traps would be one thing, but other things were mentioned too. You know, are there parks or other things that any of you are seeing or are planning for to bring more foot traffic?
I was wanting to ask what a grease trap was. I think, you know, amenities and these sort of like non-store space, you know, concepts, I think really put in perspective the premium on critical mass, right? Critical mass is being you own enough land and property to curate co-tenancy, create, you know, engaging spaces in and throughout the actual retail buildings. And so you really, in order to do stuff like that, especially in the urban core, you need to own a lot of land, which is really, really tough to do. When you get out into the periphery, these opportunities start to open up really significantly. And I think that's an opportunity for anyone who's active out there is, you know, take advantage of all this land that you have, because it can really just make a difference in your placemaking.
Okay, I want to get some thoughts on some of the biggest challenges that you're all facing, Adam. Maybe, you know, cost of financing. It could be permit times. The list is probably long, but what's at the top of yours?
You know, I think the challenges present opportunities. It keeps competitors at bay to some degree from coming to the market. I think we're all tasked with the same challenges, you know, sitting up here in the panel, just like you guys are sitting in the audience, of where, you know, interest rates have gone, where construction pricing has gone. We're still sitting at the very top of the market in terms of our horizontal costs for moving dirt and site work. If I had to boil it down to, you know, what I would say is at the very top, you know, and we live in a great city, but you know, there are challenges with permitting, like you're talking about. You know, I think the solution is going to be a combination of things. So I don't know that I could isolate just one challenge. I think, you know, there's barriers to getting deals done just because of the culmination of all those factors, and so. I think a solution to it is, you know, hopefully rates will be coming down, you know, this next year, and hopefully construction costs will see a little bit of softening. I think what's held us to this point, allowing us to get new deals done, is tenant performance remains positive. You know, and if the consumer changes their spending habits and sales start dropping, you know, then I think we're going to see another lull potentially in even trying to get stuff done right now. The biggest gap in the market from a product type perspective are junior anchors. And so while I said only, you know, 7.5% of our deals this last year were retail, I think there's really strong demand from retail. And the guys that have existing assets are the beneficiaries of that, because if boxes come back like we saw in 2023 with Bye Bye Baby, Best Buy, and Tuesday Morning. I'm sorry, not Best Buy, Bed Bath & Beyond. And Tuesday Morning, those boxes filled. extremely fast, and I think there may be one remaining at this point. And so it's another indicator for how strong demand is. The gap in the market we have right now is with the cost related to what the tenant can actually pay. And so city incentives, you know, I think in 2025, we might see a few projects that come out with junior anchor space down in Kyle and then one in Manor. And that'll help, I think, allow for more product to be put on the ground.
David, how about you?
I want to agree with what you just said about the permitting, because that's, at least from where I sit, the number one thing that slows me down, so to speak. But I kind of want to take it a step further, and that was a great question at the end of the first panel regarding the new parking change here in the city of Austin. And I just have a general curiosity as to what the domino effect is going to be with that. So naturally, there's just, I consider it a bit of a bureaucratic morass when it comes to not only getting comments, but just some of the nonsensical comments that make absolutely no sense from the city on certain things. But is something going to have less parking than they want to see? So there's just this natural inclination to slow things down even more. That's kind of a bit of a fear that I have. Now, I'm normally a glass half full kind of guy. So where I'm looking at it right now is, okay, the parking limitations kind of being not cared about anymore. That's a good thing, because you might have some site plans that are tight on parking from a legal standpoint, but there's really plenty of available parking. So why can't I put this restaurant into this space? That sort of deal. So that's just my thoughts on it. I don't know if you guys share a similar opinion on that kind of stuff.
I can share with my experience. Supply chain is still a problem. I signed a deal with Tesla to have 24 charging stations in my location, and they tell me it takes 8 months to get a transformer. So it's just amazing how slow everything is. I'm trying to get some air conditioning units. It's taking me 3-4 months to get it. You figure, 3 years after COVID, we should be okay, but we're not 100% okay yet. So it's very slow to get things done, and you're right, the permitting with the city, it's a very slow process. It can take 6 months sometimes. So everything is slower than expected.
I think it's interesting that none of the panelists mention rates, really. And biggest challenge, I think, if you were to go to this, this conference, the version for multifamily or industrial, that'd probably be number one on everyone's mind. But retail yields are such that there is actually positive leverage out there to be had. I think life cos right now are probably pricing in the sixes, right, on a probably, 5 to 10 year deal. And so there is positive leverage to be had in the asset class. And so I think that has set it aside from a lot of the other asset classes in 2023, 2024. For me, I have two big challenges that affect underwriting. One is that TI costs are stubbornly high. We've seen contraction in construction costs and a lot of the other asset classes that we develop. But in this TI fit-out space, there really has not been a lot of contraction in construction pricing. And then secondarily, a lot of the trades that happen in retail, especially in the smaller side, are being sold by individuals. And if we look at the way the real estate price is, it has a lot to do with who's selling. Right, the public markets we get to see repriced every single day. The private markets, they price quarterly, but they don't report, so no one really knows what's on book. Individuals don't have any sort of valuation requirements. All they have is, this is what I want, right? And they're very hesitant to accept anything less than the last thing that they were offered, which in this case, a lot of time that's in 2021. So I think that seller expectations and just realization that the market has changed significantly over the past 24 months is going to unlock a lot of transaction activity, hopefully, over the next couple of years. But right now, those are my two biggest challenges. Sellers being stuck on 21 prices and TI costs is remaining stubbornly really high.
Jeff, I think the parking was a special passion project of yours too.
Well, the parking is interesting, and I'll speak to it from our existing portfolio of, we've got about 1 million square feet, 10 or so plus projects really scattered throughout the market, and many of those within Austin proper. And as we saw the change coming, you know, it created an excitement of, oh, we can really take and do some things that we hadn't done before. But I don't know that it's going to necessarily translate into that. I mean, you know, from a logistic perspective, you know, we are, you know, heavy on large parking lots, and people come and park and want the experience. And while we technically will be able to go and park restaurants, it's going to be at the detriment to our other tenants in the center potentially. And so it's something that it's going to be interesting to see what other, you know, owners and landlords do in the market. And, you know, ultimately you may see some impact that isn't as intended on this, and it may be to sacrifice the sustainability of other tenants. And so I think there has to be a very careful balance in that. But at the same time, I think you're going to be able to activate some areas and smaller projects that haven't been before. And so that'll, it'll be exciting to see.
Good. I was wanting to get back into some more of the economics, Roger, and one of the things that we were talking about just in the different asset classes, certainly with office and even multifamilies, you know, those have been impacted by financing and interest rates and things like that. But retail is still there, and we're able to do some things with it to keep projects moving forward, but maybe scaling back a little bit. So I was curious for you to go a little bit deeper into the comment you're talking about for TI financing and with retail projects as a whole.
Yeah, I think that especially over the last 24, you know, probably in 36 months, capital has gone almost exclusively into multifamily and industrial because office became just a completely uninvestable asset class. That is going to have to diversify. That is not going to go into office. And I don't think that there's enough niche asset classes out there for the capital to go around. So that puts a lot of dollars coming off of office and into something that is not multi, is not industrial, and is not office, which leaves retail, which has been performing fundamentally extraordinarily well for a pretty extended period of time now post-COVID. So I think that we could see an influx of capital into the asset class that is going to compress cap rates, even, you know, well, you're going to have wrestling interest rates and cap rates are going to be wrestling with each other a little bit, but net new demand from capital, I think, will be a positive force for the retail investment landscape.
Adam, how about you with Endeavor?
I'll put on the development hat, and the opportunities for multifamily slowing down and industrial slowing down, you know, there's been a gap in land pricing for what we can afford to pay. And so we think it will provide opportunities. There's still a gap in the market today. Retail is it's an amenity for these larger projects. And so it remains so. And we think that there'll be additional opportunities in the burbs for development along those lines.
David.
I'm going to look at it from more of the institutional standpoint, just as interest rates go down naturally, the cost of capital goes down for a lot of institutional groups, and there will be more just overall activity in the retail sector, but they might be able to have equity offerings, and they might be able to, you know, finance larger projects and stuff like that. So there will be a trickle-down as that. Even if it levels off for a little bit, that's going to cause some of the share prices of companies to go up, which is going to lower their cost of capital.
And we've seen projects at BRR where we're doing a shopping center redevelopment, and a project a couple of years ago, we would redevelop the entire property, and more recently, we're cutting back. You know, those things are getting value engineered, we're pulling scope out, maybe we're not touching every building in a particular shopping center. Are you seeing that currently in this market, sort of waiting for the cost of financing to come back down, those interest rates to come back down?
I would say yes. New construction is tough right now, just with the general hard cost construction sort of staying stubbornly high, and interest rates just driving up the cost of capital. I mean, it's not only interest rates in terms of like risk-free and spread, but it's also just the supply of construction lenders out there that are active is substantially less. There's been a huge pullback in from the banks, which are, you know, you're typically probably one of your bigger construction lenders, especially following the SVB collapse, right? So I think those two things are making new construction really tough. But like Adam kind of alluded to, I think you're going to start seeing in some geographies, I think you'll start to see municipalities step up, states step up to sort of incentivize and juice those deals into existence. But on a just traditional, we want to go build something, it's a very tough environment. Toughest environment that I think we've seen since, you know, maybe even like GFC.
I think you bring a good point up as it relates to incentives, and I think we are seeing, you know, really 360 in the marketplace, and you know, going from Kyle to Leander to Huddle, we're seeing a lot of 380 agreements and a lot of contributions from the respective municipalities to fill that gap a little bit, and you know, and that's a combination of, you know, rebates on sales as well as some actual grants, you know, based on certain metrics. And I think that, you know, the challenges, which are all of the list of items that we've gone through here, you know, there's got to be movement in, you know, more than one area to kind of restart the development in meeting that demand. And so it's going to be interesting to see, you know what areas begin to retreat. You know, we're about to break ground on several projects in Dallas. And, you know, we've really struggled with construction pricing for the last 18 months. But for the first time, we're seeing numbers really come down in the range of 25% to 30% on construction. Not seeing it here yet, but, you know, maybe that is foretelling us to what's coming, and certainly hopeful that that's the case here.
So let's talk about some future predictions. And Bo, I'll start with you first. If you had a magic wand and you could start solving some problems, Adam, talk to it too, where would you start?
Well, I predict the interest rate will go down, and I hope the second half of the year. I believe there will be a lot of products for sale. Some owners that have, let's talk about my experience. The reason I bought Arborwalk, because the seller, which is a major Simon, did not want to refinance, and they want a quick close, and I will see a lot more of it. People that would need to refinance, they have a 2.5% interest rate, and they go into a 6-7%. They want to unload the property, so I believe there will be a lot of product coming to the market the next 24 months, and I'm ready to buy some.
David, how about you?
I agree. I think the acquisition activity, I mean, it's only a few weeks into this year. I've already seen a couple of deals come to my markets. That's not necessarily Austin, but there's some projects that I wasn't quite expecting to see, and I got an investment summary, and that was really nice to see, and I'm hopeful that's a sign of things to come. I'd love to be able to predict the Powerball numbers. I think that'd be pretty cool if you know. No, I try.
I think that's a different panel, but okay.
You know, when it gets over $250 million, that's when it really makes sense to play. But yeah, I would agree. Acquisition activity is going to pick up this year.
Can I ask Bo to look into your magic wand or your a little bit, and in terms of that next 24 months acquisition opportunities presenting themselves? The challenges I look at today is, you know, we're in a market that's never in I think in the history of anyone who's been in this room had greater occupancy at, you know, 97%, and, you know, projects are all seem to be performing well. What do you think is going to be that pressure point that causes folks to put stuff on the market at this point?
Well, obviously the refinancing is the big point. I mean, they try to get out of the old debt, but I would love to get some property that has some vacancy in it, but it's hard to get. Most properties are usually full, but I don't know what to tell you. I can tell you that product will come, and I can be selective about what makes sense, but there'll be a lot to choose from. My opinion will be a lot of product coming next 24 to 36 months, and we all can choose and see what we want to do. Being a small company gave me the advantage to close faster compared to other REITs that may take some more time, and that's my advantage. Being smaller actually is a huge advantage. That's why I won ArborWalk, because six others took him 3 months to make a decision, and I made it in 1 hour. So that's a big difference. So I see a lot of product come to the market, and we're going to fight on it, and the best guy win.
Can I jump in on that too?
Go ahead.
You're going to see some developers that want to do other projects, and that's what I've seen already, and they just need that capital. And it's not that they can't afford the refinancing of that particular asset, but they're just, like you said, you've seen some construction pricing go down a little bit. I mean, it's not back to where it was, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago, but these guys want to do their projects, and they're going to need to structure them somehow, so it just makes sense to try to offload some assets.
One thought I've had is that I've heard the term, you know, folks are looking for tenants to fill these spaces who have creditworthiness. So talk about the types of tenants you're looking for if you can, when those vacancies open up.
Obviously, credit is very important. I mean, if you give somebody TI $50 to $100 a foot, you want to make sure they're going to be there the next 10 years. So credibility is very important, the type of business, the co-tenancy with the other tenants, so it can help each other. All those are factors as far as who you want to choose to fill your vacancy. It is a very slow process to decide, but once you decide, they're usually there for 20 years.
You know, I'll say with the lockup on the challenges with new development, we've taken the opportunity over the last couple of years to begin to maximize value of our existing assets. And we talk about tenants, you know, we have looked at the tenants that are kind of those weaker credit tenants and weaker links, and with the demand that we've had, we've been able to replace and upgrade and put better quality tenants in. So it's been from an opportunity perspective, that's where we found that kind of ability to do that, and it's proven successful. I think it's going to continue to. I mean, I've got more projects that are 100% than I've ever been able to say that we do, and so it's one of those things where we're constantly monitoring the sales and health of our tenants, and if we see that weakness, we're able to kind of maneuver and make those changes for better quality tenants and credit.
Then before we turn things open to questions, I want each of you to have a chance to kind of give some final thoughts or even predictions. Adam, if we'll start with you and go down the road.
I think it's a good time to be on the landlord side. We think development opportunities will be ripe in 24 leading into 25. Again, our hope is that we can put product on the ground that doesn't include just your anchors, your Costco's, your HEB's, but also some junior anchors. And we raised a fund, our third fund, $650 million that we completed in 2023, and we're opportunistic for whatever that might bring. So if it's bulk land purchases, we're closing on 330 acres and Cedar Park this month. We close on a couple hundred acres in Georgetown. If it's existing assets, or if it's growth of just ground up on the outskirts of town, we're opportunistic with and bullish on Central Texas.
Jeff.
I predicted that the Cowboys were going to win last week, so I don't think that anything I'm going to say is going to have any value. I don't have the crystal ball, and I foresee some hopeful things in the coming year, and like Bo says, the expectation that acquisition opportunities surface, that's going to be our primary focus in sourcing those. I think development is going to it's going to lag behind until we see some changes in the challenges that make the economics of those deals work.
I'll give I'll give two predictions. One that is kind of bad but ends up being really good, and the other one that's just good. So the one that's bad is that we're underestimating the lagged effects of the Fed's rate hikes, and we actually see some sort of consumer-driven recession in 2024, in which case we'll see rates come way down. We'll probably see vacancy in Austin probably not be that bad. Maybe that results in like a 5-7% vacant market, which is still a great market. But we can build again, and rates are way down, so we can buy stuff on a value-add basis. So that ends up, I think, pretty good. And then Austin's in a great place to rebound economically over the next sort of 24 months following that, and everything looks really good. The just good scenario is that we do not get a consumer-driven recession. Austin remains very strong, 3% vacant. And we see just an absolute, you know, just wave of capital come into the asset class that drives cap rates down.
I predict the Austin market will stay strong next 5 to 10 years. I don't see any slowdown. I don't see the vacancy go up more than 1 or 2%. As I mentioned earlier, I believe there'll be a lot of opportunities to increase the inventory in this market. I built a very large reserve ready for the next wave, and my prediction is that market will stay strong, and I'll be able to get some more.
My prediction is that things will go well for the first 3 to 6 months of the year, and then we're going to be heavy into election stuff, and election years are typically volatile, and that's why I'm kind of couching any predictions with a big old asterisk right there, because who knows what the heck's going to go on. Stuff happens so quickly anymore that I don't know.
I like an asterisk on my predictions as well.
Yeah. So who knows? I mean, we got, never mind, I'm not getting political up here, but that's another forum for another day. But yeah, and just want to say anything I might say for a future prediction could be totally different in 10 months from now.
Good. Are there any questions from the audience for our panel?
Yeah, so the question is, you know, maybe not downtown core, maybe not in the burbs, but is there kind of a, you know, in between that we're looking at? I think you're referring to vertical mixed use. The answer is yes, and, you know, probably Bordenberry is the best example, where we closed on 19 acres over at Cesar Chavez in 183. And it'll be heavy multifamily, it'll be heavy retail as well, you know, relatively speaking heavy. We'll have a hotel condo piece, we believe. No office contemplated right now. But, yeah, we see those markets that have organic growth. Saltillo is probably another example of that, where you have a lot of organic growth from a retail perspective. It's dense in the area. It's got proximity to downtown. So, yes is the answer, and we're still looking for opportunities like that to create, you know, call it 100,000 feet of retail with, you know, 1,200 apartments, hotel, condo, and, you know, probably one anchor opportunity.
Me too.
Have any of you seen in the market any tokenization of real estate assets, either in the property itself or the cash flow?
I heard that someone paid their rent in Bitcoin the other day. I've not seen anything like that thus far. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because it only means more capital, right, for the same amount of stuff, and that's always good for asset values. But no, I've not seen anything yet.
How's the shift in work at home made a difference in your analytics when you look at daytime populations?
I love this trend. I think it's huge. I think it puts a much bigger focus on demographics, meaning what is the immediate area surrounding a center look like, because you're going to get much more exposure to those demographics than you once did, right? In pre-COVID, you had all those great demographics leaving that area for a really significant portion of the day. Now you're getting more of them for more of the day, and they're very powerful consumers. So I love the trend.
I'd echo that. And, you know, it's just enhanced suburban retail and that experience. And so sales have continued to climb in those markets.
Well, I'd like to thank our panel today. Gentlemen, thank you so much. And with that, we'll turn it over to Todd.